Hello and welcome to Talk About Jazz with Doug Hall. I'm your host, Doug Hall. And today we have a guest who is both a drummer, composer, and band leader and involved in many other projects. We have Phil Haynes with us today. And welcome, Phil.
Greetings.
Thank you.
So great to be on.
I'm going to go ahead and cover just a brief introduction of your career, which won't be all-encompassing, but I feel it's important to acknowledge the credits of individual jazz artists. So once again, as jazz drummer, composer, and band leader, you've had collaborations with many of seminal musicians of this generation. I have saxophonist Anthony Braxton, Ellery, is it Eskelin?
Yes.
And David Liebman, of course, legendary saxophone player, trumpeters Thomas Heberer, Herb Robertson, and Paul Smoker, bassist Mark Dresser, Ken Filiano. And Drew Gress.
Yep.
Keyboard artist David Kikoski. And Denman.
Tikoski.
And Denman Maroney. Oh. And Michelle Rosewoman. Vocalist
yep.
Theo Bleckman. Nicholas Homer. And Hank Roberts. And finally, violinist Mark Feldman. I also have.
Not a bad starting point, huh?
So in addition to those credits, you are featured on more than 85 releases from numerous American and European record labels, and yeah. Also a part of a composer's collective called Joint Venture.
Yeah.
And your outlets include several bands of different genre styles. We have the Romantic Jazz Grass String Band, Free Country. I have the saxophone trio No Fast Food, the classic piano trio Daydream featuring Steve Rudolph, and finally your solo project Sanctuary.
That's right.
All right.
And I have
that covers a lot of ground.
I also have some new. Yeah, it does cover some ground, and I also have new trios with two of the trumpet players you met.
Okay.
You mentioned, and that's Tomas Haber with Ken Filiano, and also Herb Robertson with Ken Filiano. Two separate trios, one electrified and one all acoustic. And man, do we have fun.
Good. Wow. Well, that's a full plate. So again, welcome and thank you for connecting with us. We're obviously going to cover some ground here today in 30 minutes. And if we go over, that's okay. Your musical background, your musical directions, and more specifically, we'll talk about your recent recording project with your jazz trio, No Fast Food, and the release of Codas with the S in parentheses in June of this year, which is,
yes.
I believe, if I have this correctly, the first of several planned musical projects through 2025.
Yes, we're letting it all hang out here.
Wow. Well, we're going to try to cover ground here, and I thought I would start out with kind of backing up to where you were when you really began your musical career, talking a bit about your musical background and your early development as a jazz drummer. I mean, could you touch on that a bit?
Yeah, you bet. My first jazz recordings, I begged my parents, you know, for drum lessons for mm-hmm. about 9 or 10 years. A family lore has me playing, assembling pots and pans and Lincoln Logs and whatever, and playing with the hi-fi, you know, when I was less than 2 years old. And it hasn't changed. It really hasn't. And when I was in, I think it was fifth grade, so 1971, that'll date me. Mm-hmm. New records that came out. I finally got drum lessons of this hip young guy from Pacific University who, which was in my hometown. I got to study with him and he was a student there from San Francisco. And so he introduced me to all at the same time, Tower of Power, Buddy Rich, and Elvin Jones.
Wow.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. And those records all arrived, Christmas 1971 or 72.
Okay.
And Buddy Rich's Live at Ronnie Scott's, Live in London, amazing. And I started, was able to start playing with that immediately, you know, playing the skeleton rhythm to the opener, which Rock Beat 1A actually works, you know. You can, I could play along with it even though I couldn't even begin to decode, you know, his virtuosic mastery, you know. And, you know, Tower of Power, I couldn't play along with very easily because it was so funky to start with. But I got there shortly because I had a great teacher. And, of course, I was listening to Master Garibaldi. And then there's Elvin Jones, and I put this on. And that album, by the way, featured none Merry-Go-Round, featured none other than David Liebman on almost on every track. And Chick Corea makes appearances on that, and it's one of I think it's his first recording of of La Fiesta. And man, this record is just brilliant. It is one of my favorites to this day. And what's fascinating, I asked Lieb about it when I was you know, it's like pretty much my first record was studio record with Elvin, and I just joined his band and whatever, and I said, you know, this is just amazing, but it was so dark and I just had never heard anything like it. And of course, completely mystified by the drumming and the grooves. And I couldn't play anything along with it. So I would listen to it multiple times every year and come back to it religiously, you know, rich, it was a ritual to come back. And about 10 years later, I come back from my first semester at Coe College where I met Paul Smoker and all of a sudden, of course, with, you know, a semester with Paul, I could hear it. It just, I put, because my favorite thing to do is I put my headphones on in the basement and with my drum set and start playing immediately to records or the radio. And as a matter of fact, as soon as I'd get off the plane, I'd stop on the way back home at the used record store in Portland, Django's, and I would buy everything, you know, everything with Miles on it that I that I could find, everything with Coltrane on it, of course, everything with Elvin on it, and so on and so forth. And guess what? There's, you know, David Liebman keeps popping up. And isn't it amazing? 1972 to 2022 when we recorded this last record, Codas, and it's 50 years. He's been in my head.
That's amazing.
And in my ears. And who would have thunk? That I could end up playing with a guy on a record that mystified me for a decade.
Well,
that's
wonderful and formidable, and quite
formidable. You got it, man.
Yeah. Wow. Well, look, I'm going to take you forward to Pennsylvania and 2003 and your relationship with Bucknell University. I have some notes here related to the founding of a nationally noted jazz chamber series called Jazz at Bucknell. And you've been a musical educator there. You've developed ensembles, obviously taught. Could you talk a little bit about that period of your life and your ongoing connection with Bucknell University?
Absolutely. I let's see where to start. We skipped over New York City. So, you know, 4 years with Paul in Iowa, and then I went straight to New York City for 20-some years and made, and that's where, of course, you know, you make all your connections.
We can back that up because, actually, funny enough, I had that as a following question. So,
well, good, but we'll come back to it.
We'll come back to that
next. I made my career, but I also noticed when, at you know, toward the end of my 20-plus years in New York City, I also noticed that it's like, as successful as I had been artistically, and it was clear, you know, that that was working out, you know, and the recordings, you know, attested to that. And, you know, all the guys in my, the corner store community, whether it was Dave Douglas or Drew Kress or Herb Robertson or Ellery Escalon or Tim Byrne or, you know, you name it, right? Let alone Paul Smoker, all these people. And we, you know, they're Ben Maunder, they're all household names now in Europe, right? They all succeeded. And one of the things that happened was I was getting dark at that time, right around 2000, and feeling like, man, maybe my ship isn't ever going to come in, and I don't want to be dark. I noticed some people I really respected had gotten dark in the media, you know, and let it out that they were frustrated. And it was like, oh, I don't want to ever be like that. And so I realized, hey, I'm supporting my music to do anything that I want, which I did, right, by painting, plastering high-end apartments in New York City. Well, I can do the same thing in Lewisburg. And I can still come to New York City. It's just a couple hours away. So I moved. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I soon ended up painting and plastering the historic Bucknell President's House. And who should be coming in but a new president, Brian Mitchell. And I ended up being the last painter on the job because he had, you know, it was an old house without closets. And so furniture was made for him and, you know, closets and whatever. And so I finished the stuff for him. We talked about everything. So I never brought up to, you know, the new president that I was a musician.
Okay.
Fast forward 9 months and Dee and I are coming out of a restaurant and Brian and his wife, Mary Jane, are coming into a restaurant and we talk like old friends for 10 minutes in the hallway, in the foyer. And they keep asking us to sit down with them and whatever. Finally, we sat down with them and had some more wine. Dee said something and Brian said, oh, I didn't know you two were musicians. And she says, oh, well, I'm just an amateur musician, but Phil's an internationally, you know, recognized percussionist and composer and leader. And he was like, you're kidding. And 20 minutes later, I had a $35,000 a year series, Jazz at Bucknell, established. And I said, wow. You let me bring in. I said, you're just in a great place. You're a half a day drive from New York City. With $35,000, I can put on 6 to 8 concerts a year of there's no backline. Guys come and they set up, they play acoustically in this great hall we have with this great piano. Mm-hmm. And next thing you know, it's still going on today.
I'm going to kind of let you summarize a bit of your New York City experience, which funny enough was my second question. And I'd left with a broader question that if you can manage your way around this, being as you've been a musician working in the performance scene and the nightclub scene in New York City, when you round out the end of your answer, if you could just touch on how has that world, the jazz scene, changed in New York City from when you began to where it is now? So I'll let you.
Okay.
I mean, I don't want to make it too broad with the time
It's a great question. Let me say, Paul Smoker, I would say, gosh, can't we get, this would be in the 80s, the early 80s.
Yep.
Gee, you know, can't we get more for this gig? He says, man, 20 years ago, it was $100 a gig. It's still $100 a gig.
Wow.
And it's 20 years later. And he says, you know, 20 years ago, I could buy a good steak dinner, for $6. And he says, I ordered a custom, you know, custom Chevy, you know, and it was $3,500 made for me. And he says, you know, that you can't, he says, what? It's four times. Those costs are four times now.
Right.
That was in the 80s. And of course it stayed that way. I got out of here to Iowa, to New York. It's $100 a gig. If you're lucky, unless you're playing club dates, you know, playing wedding bands,
right.
Which means you can't play what you want to necessarily. And, now it's door gigs or guys are, the transition happened where you're either playing for the door. You're no longer, you know, guaranteed enough.
Okay.
To bring in a band, or you're helping to fund it by, you know, in New York, basically, if I play a free gig, you know, I'm playing improv, pure improv with friends I want to play with. Oh, yeah, I'll take a share of the door. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm playing standards, I'll do the same thing if there's no guarantee. But as soon as I'm playing somebody else's music, I need to be paid.
Right.
As soon as there's rehearsals, I need to be paid.
Right.
And likewise, I do the same for other people. Anthony Braxton taught Paul and taught myself this. It's like, I take very little. The leader's fee, I put right back into the band and make sure they're all taken care of so that as difficult as the music and the business and the travel might be, it's always business. It's never personal.
Sure. Okay.
You get better performances that way,
right.
Which is what I always did with my recordings. it was like, you know, we didn't do demo recordings. We did it for real. And everybody plays different, which is interesting because psychologically you're different. Well, now there's, you know, I used to get, you know, I don't know, 20, 25 years ago, I would get my usual check from BMI, you know, $1,000, $1,500, $300 every year, right, for all my compositions that are out and getting played on record, especially in Europe and whatever. And, you know, then streaming came in and CDs and record companies contracted. I haven't seen a check in 20 years.
Right.
Because of the streaming reality.
So that's
what we're dealing with. So now everybody, even somebody like, you know, Jason Moran, who, you know, records for Blue Note, also has his own Bandcamp where he puts out the things that he self-produces and self-pays for, mm-hmm. right? And does it himself, whether there are physical copies available or not. I mean, everybody, the good thing about all this is that musicians and artists have taken back the reins of control so that when your record goes out of print, it's not out of public accessibility, right? And that's what used to happen. You'd sell your master tapes for less than what they cost to a fine European boutique label or whatever. It would mm-hmm. come out, and 3 years later, it's sold out, you know, the 1,000, 1,500, 15,000 copies, right? Whatever it was, they're sold out, and now it's out of print. And then those companies, so many of them, ended up going bankrupt when the industry changed 20 years ago.
Right.
And so now you don't own your rights anymore.
Right. Unbelievable.
So people, artists said, hey, this isn't worth it. I started, actually, I only sold two projects and then three projects, I guess. And then I realized this isn't working for me. It's going out of print and out of availability, and this music is lasting. And so I started doing long-term leases with companies.
Right.
And that worked. And then, of course, the Bandcamp phenomenon came here in the last 5-10 years.
Right.
And
right.
I finally have managed to build my Bandcamp so that I'm making, you know, the lunch money that I was on tour selling hard copies. I now sell every year on Bandcamp by people being attracted.
Right. Well, clearly the audience listening and really the larger audience of music listeners aren't aware of how, you know, the reality of making a living in jazz. You know, I'm reminded of a phrase I heard from a nightclub owner, and this goes way back. The old joke was, how do you make a million in jazz? You start with five. Right, you've heard it, right? There's different variations.
No, keep going.
Right, how do you make $1 million in jazz? You start with $5 million.
Yeah, there you go. That's like the jazz musician that won the lottery, and people said, well, what are you going to do with the money? He said, I'm going to keep working until it's gone.
That's a better punch to it, because it takes you a minute to get that, to say, ouch. Well, look, in the interest of time here, I'm going to move forward to your most recent release of Codas,
please,
by your trio, No Fast Food. We have two cuts to play, and I'm first going to play Beloved Refracted, which is a quieter tune, and then we'll follow with a little Iowa Get Down, which is more
great.
Energized.
Yes, a little Iowa Get Down is what No Fast Food, this is our third record together.
Your third record
together.
And
my fourth with Liebman.
Okay.
And by that group, and my fourth with Liebman overall. And a little Iowa Get Down is what people expect No Fast Food to do. It's energized, crazy. You know, we have a great time.
Got it.
And Beloved Refracted is the kind of coda that this band is involved with, because Dave is in his late period.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the kind of music that was magical last December when we recorded.
Okay.
Anyway, Beloved Refracted is based on, it's a piece written for my wife based on the letters of her name, Deanne Castile.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. The intro helps with that, as the piece is quiet and reflective and thoughtful. So we'll begin with Beloved Refracted, and we'll just listen to maybe like a minute and a half and then fade out. And if you want to say a few words about the piece, that's fine, and I might reflect upon it. And then we will go into a little Iowa Get Down.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, what a very meditative piece. I've listened to it several times, and it sinks in a little bit deeper when I'm able to listen to it quietly, as the each instrument seems to be on its own sort of like meditative narrative. It's very soft, but very emotional.
Yes, thanks. I noticed Coltrane's Ballads record.
Yes.
You know,
okay.
This true romance and quiet and calm was so affecting, even with his classic quartet, you know, and I've always felt that beyond quartets, boy, if you can play trios have this amazing ability that each person can be doing their own thing, right? Completely their own thing. Mm-hmm. And yet, if
right.
you have it right and they're sensitive, right?
Right.
Those three separate pieces of information are more than the sum of their parts, and people can hear it. You know, we know from psychological studies that people can keep track of those three things. Once you get to four and more, fewer and fewer people can.
Ah, good observation. Right. So the focus can remain on three.
Yeah. And trios have always been, and duos, mm-hmm. but trios have always been the magic in my career, whether it was Paul Smoker's trio, right, or the trios I have now with Tomas Haverer and Herb Robertson, or, you know, this trio, mm-hmm. No Fast Food. You know, I keep coming back to trios because, or piano trios, the same mm-hmm. thing. It's like, oh, the drummer, me, mm-hmm. everybody has all this freedom so that you don't just have to be required. Once you go to quartet and quintet, rhythm sections tend to become more and more traditional.
Sure.
Because, or they fall into roles instead of being more expansive because other people have to have room for them. Whereas
right.
in a trio, everybody can be quite expressive.
Yes.
And it'll hold the magic.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's just so many examples. I'm almost thinking of how I listened to an older Bill Evans release where he was recorded in Europe, and there they were, and it was just so intense because of what he's doing on the piano, but also what the bassist and the drummer is doing. It was just amazing. And
well, it's interesting you bring up Bill Evans because his bassist that was the first revolutionary one back, you know, in the early 60s,
right?
Mm-hmm. And you know, Scott LaFaro is the prototype for someone like Drew Gress and all the bassists
yes.
who have come after Scott.
Right.
And if you notice on that first piece, and again with A Little Iowa Get Down, Drew is the one who's playing the head.
Yes.
Not,
right.
well, I'm having Dave improvise.
Right.
And you just yeah. you can effectively turn over the predisposition and the preconceptions of what a trio is.
Yes.
And create this collective identity where anybody can be the principal at any time,
mm-hmm.
Right. And it's a welcome area, and it starts with that trio, Bill Evans' trio, way back when, and now we're you go 50, 60, 70 years later, and it's really coming to fruition.
Yeah, well, let's move to the next composition, A Little Iowa Get Down. And let's have a listen, and then I look forward to your response, and certainly I may have some reaction as well.
Counting on it, Doug.
So, wow, that has such a swing and groove to it. And again, as we were just talking about bassists being kind of playing ahead, you certainly hear the leadoff there and the takeoff on the saxophone with Liebman that just kind of soars the piece and makes it sing.
Catching the big wave, didn't he?
Catching the big wave on top of the wave.
Yeah, Lieb was riding the wave, man. He was just having a great time.
Wow. So do you want to make
and
any...
This is the tradition, mm-hmm. Doug, that this band comes from. Right after Elvin left Coltrane in the mid-60s, mm-hmm. After Rashid had joined the band, and it just didn't work out for... It might have been working out for Coltrane, but it wasn't working out for Elvin.
Got it.
And so he left the band, and for, I think, 6 weeks or so, he was with Ellington. But then he started his trio, and he had this great, great trio. And those couple of records that he put out in the late 60s, I had never heard saxophone, bass, drums trio before that.
Mm-hmm.
Then I realized, oh, there's Sonny Rollins' Way Out West. Oh, this is quite so, it's not so revolutionary. But, of course, with Elvin Jones, it is revolutionary. And, of course, it's now post-Coltrane instead of pre-Coltrane, so it's revolutionary. And I just remember his relatively simple heads just exploding into these waves like the one that you just heard Liebman grab. And then, of course, Liebman is hearing this stuff, and his recordings with Elvin happened just after that. And so no fast food when I wanted to do a trio so that I could get back to Europe and have something more compact and more explosive than, say, my quintet, Four Horns and What, and whatever that had been there, or my quartet continuum with Mark Feldman that had been there, times. It was like, oh, something more compact, something more explosive even for me, and something that I can afford.
Right? Sure.
Well, it just turned out that the few offers I would get, they weren't offering me enough not to lose money. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, I would say to them, well, Liebman plays your festival, Drew plays your festival, both as leaders and all-star bands and sidemen. I know what you pay.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, yeah, we'd rather have those bands.
Sure. Sure. Well, if you want to
lose money, you just go ahead and we'll put you on the stage because it's more than good enough.
Right.
I said, well, you don't have to tell me that.
Right. You've been living that world for a long time, as
we've just discussed.
Like, right. So
yeah, it's one thing to put your money into a recording,
live
or studio, and to understand that ECM or Blue Note or whoever, Columbia, you're not going to have a chance with yet, right? You haven't been at the right place at the right time.
Right.
Right. The introduction hasn't been made.
Right.
But it's a whole other thing to already have your records out, already have a band with multiple records, already have a band with all stars, and not get booked for money you have to have.
God, madness. Well, look,
we're
coming
baby.
to the end of our talk, but obviously this could go on for quite a long time, and we'll see about circling around later on. But I wanted to make sure that I told our listeners that you have a lot of different projects going forward, and briefly, you have an autobiography, Chasing the Masters, which is due out November of 23. You're accompanying that with a career-spanning 62-track audio compilation entitled A Life Improvised. So there is a lot going on in your life musically right now, and I want our listeners certainly to follow on that with the websites that are indicated. And thank you so much, Phil. Again, we covered some territory, and we just couldn't cover
it all of it.
But
never.
It's been a wonderful...
That's a good thing.
That's a good thing. We'd be here till midnight. But wonderful to have just an open conversation with you, and thank you so much for participating and being a part of this broadcast and Talk About Jazz with Doug Hall. And I wish you all the best with particularly all the variety of projects ahead of you.
Thank you so much. Onward and upward, Doug.
Absolutely. You take care, Phil. Thank you again.
Ciao.